Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for July 2016. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. This podcast continues our theme of trade secret law. On May 11, 2016, the U.S. Defend Trade Secrets Act, or DTSA, came into effect. As you'll hear from Jean Gilles, our guest for this month's podcast, it's a new weapon for trade secret owners to use to protect and enforce their trade secret rights. Jean Gilles is a partner and intellectual property lawyer with Foley & Lardner LLP in Chicago. She's vice chair of the firm's National Intellectual Property Department and is a member and former vice chair of the Intellectual Property Litigation Practice. She handles complex patent, trade secret, trademark, copyright, and unfair competition litigation and appeals, including USPTO post-grant proceedings. But in a paper she presented at the spring meeting of the AIPLA in Minneapolis in May, her focus was on protecting and enforcing trade secrets in the digital age. She explained the important sections of the DTSA and recent case law on what constitutes, quote, reasonable efforts, end quote, to protect trade secrets. An excellent overview of the law in this area. I spoke with Jean from her office in Chicago. Hello, Jean.
Hello, Don.
So where were we before the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016 came into effect on May 11, 2016?
Prior to that time, litigants had been pursuing their trade secrets claims both in federal court and state court, but usually based on a state law statute fashioned after the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. That Uniform Trade Secrets Act had been adopted or modified in some form or fashion in about 48 states. You did have states that also had a common law way of protecting trade secrets.
So what did the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016 actually do?
What it did initially is amended the Economic Espionage Act of 1996, but it provided a civil remedy for misappropriation of trade secrets and where you could pursue that cause of action in federal court, particularly if the trade secret is related to a product or service used in or intended to be used in interstate or foreign commerce.
So I can see where that would give it federal jurisdiction. What does the trade secret, the DTSA not do?
What it doesn't do is it doesn't preempt those prior state law claims that many litigants were using before. So what we'll probably talk about later is what we're seeing now that we have this federal statute that allows you to bring your claim in the federal court without having some other federal law claim that you had to pair it with, or having to establish diversity of citizenship, as an example, if you only had your state law claim to bring. Now what we're seeing is litigants are filing in federal court, and they're making a trade secret claim, both based on DTSA, and are often also including a state law-based trade secret claim as well.
So in your paper, you refer to the most significant provisions of the DTSA as dealing with seizure orders, injunctions, and damages. So let's deal with each of those in order. Ex parte seizure orders, what do they bring to the DTSA?
So the seizure provisions of DTSA are probably some of the more key or important changes when you compare DTSA to a state trade secret statute. And they are an extraordinary remedy. And in fact, the Act provides that a federal court can only issue such a seizure order in extraordinary circumstances. And in fact, when you apply for such a seizure order, your application has to set forth a litany of factors that would be required. In particular, you've got to show that an order, let's say under Federal Rule 65 or some other form of equitable relief, would be inadequate. You'd have to show that there would be immediate and irreparable injury that would occur if the seizure is not ordered. You've got to show harm to the applicant and that that harm outweighs any harm to the legitimate interests of the person against whom the seizure order would be directed. The applicant's got to show that the information is in fact a trade secret, that it was misappropriated, or that the person used improper means to take the trade secret of the applicant. You've got to show that the target has actual possession of the trade secret or whatever property or information you want to be seized. You've got to show with reasonable particularity the matter you actually want seized and where it is, to the extent you know that. The person against whom the seizure should be ordered, and anyone acting in concert with that individual to make sure the information isn't destroyed, moved, or hidden, particularly if the court were to, or the applicant were to provide notice. And finally, you've got to show that the applicant has not publicized the requested seizure. So again, this section A2 of the new 1836, subsection B2, has a litany of requirements that when you're asking the court, give me a seizure order, things that you have to put forth in making that request.
The DTSA deals with injunctions as well. What provisions are those?
Sure. The type of injunctions available under the DTSA are drawn from Section 2 of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. But some key components under DTSA are you can't use an injunction to prevent a person from entering into an employment relationship or otherwise conflict with applicable state laws prohibiting restraints on trade. And again, I think this was an attempt by the drafters of the DTSA. They didn't want a law that would unfairly prohibit employee mobility. So the type of injunction that can be awarded is one that is narrowly tailored, and you might be able to get employee restrictions therein, but again, it's got to be narrowly tailored to prevent actual or threatened trade secret information. And it can't be based solely on information that that employee knows.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one because what it seems to be doing is, I know some jurisdictions have the concept of the doctrine of inevitable disclosure, that if an employee leaves the business with the information in his or her head, then sooner or later they're going to inevitably disclose it to the new employer. But this was an interesting carve-out or requirement at least, that it's not just what the employee knows, but whether there's a risk of the employee actually disclosing it. Could you explain that a little further?
Yes. So since the PepsiCo case that came out of Illinois in the Seventh Circuit, there has been this doctrine of inevitable disclosure, which is the concept of a person who's been given access to and information about a company's trade secrets because of their intimate access and familiarity. If they go to a competitor and a similar business, that person can't help but inevitably disclose information that he or she learned in their prior employ. And some courts, based on that doctrine, have crafted restrictions on that employee's ability, let's say, to go to a competitor. Here, I think what DTSA is attempting to do is saying, I'm not going to allow you to get an injunction to prevent an employee from going from company A to B merely based on what he or she knows. You're only going to get an injunction that's narrowly tailored to prevent actual or threatened trade secret misappropriation. So you've got to show that there's a high risk that this individual in their new employment is going to actually or likely misappropriate or disclose the trade secrets of their former employer. So DTSA is not a backdoor mechanism to get a non-compete, and I think the drafters wanted to be sure that it wasn't a federal expansion of this inevitable disclosure doctrine. Now, there are some states which still recognize it, like Illinois. I believe Connecticut is another. And there are also a series of states that expressly reject it. And there have been some studies such there's a state-by-state analysis of the inevitable disclosure doctrine in the Marquette Intellectual Property Law Review. An analysis was done in 2012, which kind of takes you state by state and gives you some examples of states like Louisiana as one example that rejects the doctrine.
Now, the DTSA also allows for enhanced damages and, in certain circumstances, an award of attorney fees. Could you explain what those provisions are?
Sure. So Section 1836B3B of the DTSA relates to monetary damages, and it's adapted from Section 3 of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. And there it provides that a court can award damages for the actual loss and any unjust enrichment caused by the trade secret misappropriation, or alternatively, an award of a reasonable royalty. Similarly, subsection B3C and D of the DTSA provides for enhanced damages of up to 2 times the amount of monetary damages and attorney's fees. And attorney's fees are available and enhanced damages are available where the trade secret misappropriation was willful and malicious. And these provisions are also akin to sections 3 and 4 of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. There's also a provision that provides for a potential award of attorney's fees to the accused defendant. So if you look at 1836B3D, it says that an accused defendant can get a potential award for attorney's fees upon showing that there was bad faith in bringing the trade secret claim, or alternatively, where a motion to terminate an injunction raised by the defendant was opposed by the plaintiff in bad faith.
Now, you mentioned that the Defend Trade Secrets Act really came out of or amends the Economic Espionage Act. I was interested in your paper where you talked about the fact that there's an obligation to come back and report about what effect this legislation has had on theft of trade secrets by foreign entities. Could you explain that sort of interconnection?
Sure. So Section 4 of the Act requires not later than 1 year after the date of enactment, so the date of enactment, May 11th of 2016, so within 1 year, not later than 1 year within enactment and biannually thereafter, the Attorney General is to provide a report on the theft of trade secrets occurring abroad. And that report that the AG would make would be in consultation with the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator, the Director of the Patent and Trademark Office, and the heads of other appropriate agencies. And the report in this instance would be made to the committees on the Judiciary of the Senate and the House.
So was this act itself driven primarily politically by a fear of theft of trade secrets by foreign entities, or was it a combination of that and the domestic threats, commercial threats?
I do think both. There certainly have been some high-profile trade secret cases, such as the trade secret case involving DuPont that was widely reported, where there was some misappropriation of those trade secrets abroad. And even I think in some of the legislative history notes or commentary on DTSA, when they talk about what are those circumstances in which a seizure might be appropriate. One example is when you have a defendant who is seeking to flee the country or is planning to disclose the trade secret to a third party that might be a foreign entity or a party that's not otherwise amenable to enforcement of a U.S. court's orders. So certainly the foreign entity or risk of misappropriation by a foreign entity or a person working in concert with a foreign entity was of concern. But I think what we also see is there have been a number of reports about the loss of revenue and the hit to the U.S. economy locally and domestically by trade secret theft. And how could we enact a statute that would provide a remedy, perhaps with more teeth, give people other enforcement options, and really put trade secrets on par with other forms of intellectual property? Because when you look at patents, as an example, or copyrights, or trademarks, as other examples, those are forms of intellectual property where you have a federal claim that you can make and pursue that claim in federal court. And we now, many, many years later, finally have a federal claim where you can pursue trade secret theft civilly, because, of course, the Economic Espionage Act primarily dealt with criminal trade secret misappropriation. Now you have a civil remedy that you can pursue for trade secret theft in federal court.
In your paper, you discuss a few litigation strategies. The problem with trade secret lawsuits have always been, in my mind, one of the aspects anyway, the pleading aspect, which is how much of the trade secret do you have to disclose in the pleading itself in order for the defendant to appreciate the case that's being brought against him, her, or it. Where are things in terms of pleadings, both with respect to the DTSA or with respect to state cases?
We don't have much, I think, right now with respect to analyzing whether a claim under DTSA has been pled with sufficient particularity, given that we only have 2 months of complaints being filed. I think we will see decisions by district courts in the near term. What we can look to are some cases where litigants have pursued state law trade secret claims and where the issue you raise, has the plaintiff pled with sufficient detail what the trade secrets are such that the defendant can ascertain and respond? And there have been some cases by federal courts analyzing state law-based trade secrets cases. One example I give in my paper is Tolson Embedded Systems v. Turbine Powered Technologies, a March 2016 decision from the District of Arizona. And in that case, the court granted a defendant's motion for summary judgment where a plaintiff had failed to provide detail about its alleged trade secrets. Now, that case was not at the complaint stage. It was a little later. But part of what happened in that case was you've got an initial pleading with some information about the alleged trade secrets, and then there's discovery process. And I think here what plaintiff claimed as its alleged trade secrets kept changing. It was a moving target. And the information that was provided was not with sufficient detail. So the defendant was able to prevail on that point. There is another decision from the Federal Circuit from 2014, which I also discuss in my paper, and that is one which is at the pleading stage. That is the ABB Turbo Systems v. Turbo USA case, a 2014 Federal Circuit decision, where the Federal Circuit reversed a district court's dismissal of a trade secrets complaint for failure to allege reasonable efforts. So here, it wasn't so much directed to the detail of the alleged trade secrets, but the level of detail about the plaintiff's reasonable efforts to safeguard the secrecy of those trade secrets. And there, the Federal Circuit found that information set forth in the complaint about the use of confidentiality or non-disclosure agreements and where there were prohibition on reproducing or distributing the trade secrets and the existence or presence of certain physical access or electronic access restrictions, that those were sufficient at the complaint stage to survive dismissal. But again, I think with the advent of the Twombly and Iqbal Supreme Court cases and the desire of plaintiffs to put defendants more on notice, I do think that this will be an area where defendants will attack complaints at the pleading stage. And certainly there might need to be, or people will utilize mechanisms to file things under seal, because obviously you can't disclose the secret information in a public complaint, but still there has to be a mechanism to inform with enough detail the defendant of what you plaintiff view as your trade secrets.
In your paper, you point out that the federal requirement requires you to establish that the secret qualifies as a trade secret, that it's information that derives economic value because it's not generally known, and that reasonable efforts were taken to preserve the trade secret. What does that latter term mean today?
When you say that reasonable efforts were taken?
Yes.
I think we will see a lot of additional jurisprudence on that under DTSA. But historically, I think courts look at a couple of things. They look at what you do to safeguard your trade secret vis-a-vis insiders and outsiders. By insiders, I mean your employees, the people who work within your company or your consultants, particularly those with ready access to what you deem are trade secrets. By outsiders, I mean people who may visit your company or business partners who you may enter into some type of deal or negotiation with who might have access to your trade secrets based on that deal. And then with respect to the type of safeguards you use for those insiders and outsiders, the use of agreements are key. I think in a lot of decisions that you see where the plaintiff or trade secret holder used an agreement to prevent dissemination or disclosure of its trade secrets, that was a key factor. And likewise, the absence of an agreement was often detrimental to the plaintiff's case, meaning if you didn't require your employee or your consultant or a business partner to sign a document saying, I agree to maintain this confidential information and trade secrets as secret, the absence of that agreement has been fatal to the trade secret holder in certain instances. Again, these cases are fact intense and specific, and also business dependent. The size of your business, the nature of your business may dictate what's reasonable versus what's not. And then lastly, I would say they look at physical and electronic security measures. Are doors locked? Are things segregated in certain physical locations of your facility? How do you protect against unwarranted electronic access? Do you use encryption? Do you use passwords? Are there other security software type mechanisms in place? So all of these various factors of limiting or restricting access, having appropriate protection in place via agreements where appropriate, marking things confidential, informing and educating employees about the need to protect confidential and trade secret information. These all fall within the bucket of what a court might deem as reasonable safeguards.
You mentioned earlier in our discussion about the fact that the DTSA really supplements the state laws. Under what circumstances would you advise on a strategy of suing under state law rather than the DTSA?
I would say probably in most instances, if you've got a good trade secret claim, you would pursue that claim and you'd raise both the federal DTSA claim and a state law-based claim. Some reasons you'd want to include the state law claim would be in those states that recognize the inevitable disclosure doctrine, because you may be able to get injunctive relief under your state law claim that's unavailable based on DTSA in those states like Connecticut or Illinois or some of the others where that doctrine is recognize, and where you have an employee that's gone from your company to a competitor and you want to get stronger restrictions on what that employee can or cannot do in their new employment. Another instance may be where you have trade secret information that might not rise to the level of a trade secret. So you may have a case, and I mentioned a decision in my paper, OrthoFix v. Hunter, a Sixth Circuit decision from November of 2015. And this is where the plaintiff had filed a trade secret claim, but also had a breach of contract claim, and I believe a trade secret claim under Texas law. And the plaintiff had argued that the defendant had breached a agreement by using and disclosing confidential information of the plaintiff. Here, that confidential information that was misused didn't rise to the level of a trade secret in the court's view, but a contract claim, so just your basic breach of contract claim under Texas law, did not require a finding that the information was a trade secret in order for the plaintiff to prevail. So here's a case where, you know, you as plaintiff might believe and contend that the information stolen is both confidential and a trade secret. If a court doesn't agree that it rises to the level of a trade secret for whatever reason, you still may have a legitimate breach of contract claim. So having that contract claim as an additional claim with whatever federal or state law trade secret claim you bring may still be worthwhile. And again, it also underscores the value of having employees and consultants sign agreements regarding a company's confidential information and trade secrets and other IP, as well as having business partners sign similar agreements so that you give yourself various routes to pursue relief if you feel your information has been taken.
Your paper also talked about what I found to be an interesting area of the ever-evolving landscape of trade secret law, and that had to do with LinkedIn groups that an employee might create in the course of his or her employment. Can you discuss those cases with us?
Yes, I can. So most companies these days have raised or increased their profile on social media. And one form of social media is LinkedIn. And it's particularly used in the professional context, and even by businesses as a way of organizing their customers or potential customers or targets. And two separate courts have evaluated, at least at a pleading stage, whether LinkedIn contacts might be subject to trade secret protection. So one case I mentioned in my paper is the CDM Media versus Sims case, a March 2015 case out of the Northern District of Illinois. So here, the court denied a defendant's motion to dismiss, finding that social media membership lists, such as LinkedIn contacts, may qualify as trade secrets. And here, in that case, a former employee had transferred control of a LinkedIn group that the plaintiff had allegedly owned. And plaintiff had argued that information in that LinkedIn group was used in competition with the plaintiff. And part of what the court talked about, or what could come up in some other cases, is the investment of resources and value that can be put into things like social media membership list. Because again, trade secrets have to be things that derive value from not being known. And someone could say, well, oh, I can go to the group and I can see, you know, who the contacts are. But I think there's still information that, you know, isn't always public. And then the organization and gathering of that information can still provide a company with a competitive edge. The second case came out about 6 or so months earlier from a different court, and this is the Cellular Accessories for Less versus Trinitas case out of the Central District of California from September of 2014. And again, in that case, the court denied a defendant's motion for summary judgment where LinkedIn contacts were what were alleged to be the trade secrets. And the court was analyzing this based on the California Uniform Trade Secrets Act. So the court said here there are material facts in dispute, and therefore summary judgment was denied.
So the Defend Trade Secrets Act is only a couple of months old as we speak. What's been happening so far in connection with it in terms of parties adopting it as an instrument of litigation?
So I did a search on Docket Navigator to see how many cases had been filed in the various federal district courts since the middle of May, and I found about 16 or so cases filed in a variety of federal district courts across the country, from Florida to Texas to California, Michigan, Missouri, Georgia, Delaware, and the like. And most, if not all of those cases, not only had the plaintiffs alleging violation of DTSA, but also violation of the comparable state law-based trade secret statute. And for those cases where a contract was involved, typically a breach of contract claim was also raised. I also did a search to see if any of the plaintiffs had sought an ex parte seizure. I did not find any request for a seizure order. I do think those will be to come. But again, they're going to be rare because they are an extraordinary remedy. And there's all those factors, as I mentioned earlier, that you have to show, which is a fairly high bar. But these litigants are moving for TROs, or preliminary injunctions. And out of that 15 or 16 or so cases that I've seen filed since May, about five involved ones where the plaintiff also sought a TRO. And I believe in all five such instances, the court granted that temporary restraining order, at least in part.
Well, we'll just have to see where things go. It's an interesting new venue or new weapon, if you will, for trade secret owners.
One of the things I'll also add, and it's a tactic that I think lots of litigants have always pursued in the context of TROs, and we may see more of it. In one of the reported decisions out of California, the Schein, S-C-H-E-I-N, v. Cook case, so in a reported decision from June 10 of this year, this is one where you have two competitors, so a plaintiff involved in marketing, distributing, and selling medical, dental supplies and equipment sued a competitor for a trade secret misappropriation where both a DTS claim was filed as well as a claim under the California Uniform Trade Secrets Act. And where plaintiff sought a TRO, which was granted by the court. The plaintiff had also requested, in addition to a TRO, a motion for expedited discovery, where the plaintiff wanted to obtain mirrors of all of the data stored on the former employee's personal devices, and also wanted to subpoena some of the competitor's entities and obtain additional discovery on a fast track. Here the court did not grant the motion for expedited discovery, but did grant the TRO request and also ordered the defendants to preserve all of the evidence related to the case under Federal Rule 26D1. So in effect, even though the plaintiff couldn't get the information it wanted quickly, there was at least a provision in place to preclude the defendant from destroying any documents. And there, I think such an order was needed because there had been allegations of spoliation already, where here you had an employee copy and transfer the plaintiff's information to personal devices, but also where there had been attempts to erase emails that had been sent from the plaintiff's computers to the defendant's computers, and where there were also allegations of destroying other electronic information on third-party computer systems. You know, so again, I think particularly where electronic information is involved, you know, we will see, you know, more cases like this, more requests like this for expedited discovery or preservation of evidence to preclude destruction.
Thanks very much for these insights, John.
Thank you, Don, for giving me a call. Really enjoyed speaking with you today.
John Gills is a partner and intellectual property lawyer with Foley & Lardner LLP in Chicago. For further information on John Gills' paper on protecting and enforcing trade secrets in the digital age and our other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.